All right. I got to get this right. Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. He has a catchphrase, and it is, easy does it, but do it. So this is Rob.
How's it going? I'm Rob. I'm an alcoholic. The last time I came here, they're asking us what our favorite slogan was, and that's mine. Is that good? Am I messing it up? Okay. All right, I got a sobriety date. My sobriety date is March 12, 2008. I got a big book. I got a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. His name is Tommy R. He's not my first sponsor. I got a home group. My home group is the What's Up with the Big Book meeting at Sierra Fellowship on Monday nights at 7 p.m. in Clovis. At that meeting, the format of the meeting is we read the big book, and then as people are sharing, for those of you who have been to church, when you agree with something people say in church, you say like amen, right? Well, at that meeting, if you like relate to something that someone says, people say what's up, right? So they're like, I just got another DUI. And people say, what's up, right? So the idea is to like start looking for the similarities. And I really like the format of that meeting. And we got it from Kings County when we were outreaching a trip there. So, you know, when I got here, I just had the... I'm supposed to start this timer thing. There we go. So when I got here, I'll say that I did not know I was an alcoholic. I was pretty convinced that I wasn't. I just felt like super unlucky. I felt like I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I felt like, you know, I felt like I had been lucky for a while, and then all of a sudden I just wasn't lucky no more. And I just kept not being lucky like over and over and over again. And, you know, I had come back, I'll kind of say a little bit how I drank. You know, I didn't drink every day. I just drank on Mondays when it was like Monday night football or it was, you know, pool league. Tuesday nights we had pool league. Wednesday nights when it was hump day. Thursday nights when it was one more day of the weekend. Friday it was definitely on. Saturday it was still on. And Sunday when it was like recovery day or football day. So I didn't drink every day, but I had a reason to drink every day. And most of those days I drank. You know, I also did other things, but drinking was my primary problem. I could stop those other things, but I could not stop drinking. I got my first DUI when I was 25, and at the time I was really bummed out about that. You know, let me back it up a little bit. Before, I didn't really even start drinking, and I know this is pretty weird for like a lot of people, but I didn't really start drinking until I was 21. I pretty much held off, and I know that some people don't relate to that, and some people do. But you know, there was some alcoholism in my family. I had a vague notion that maybe me and alcohol wasn't a good idea. And I did not really drink until I was 21. When I started drinking at 21, like weird things start happening. Like I went to TJ to drink and I came back with like a head wound. And when that happens, you can say what's up if that's happened, because I know that's happened to some people in here. So, you know, what I would blame that on, right, was I would blame that on, well, I'm behind the curve, right? Everybody else has been doing this for a long time, and I need to catch up. And, you know, I went on like that for a while. I got my first DUI at 25. We had a pretty nice setup in San Francisco where I was living. We had the mirror coffee table set up, and I was making a whole lot of money, a whole lot of disposable income. And things were going all right for a while. And I got my first DUI when I was 25. And I was really confused by that because I'd been pulled over like four or five times prior to that and not gotten a DUI. So when they actually gave me the first one, I was really confused by that. And I remember pulling over, you know, I was shocked. I was driving a red Mustang convertible down University Avenue in Palo Alto. There were two blondes in the car. It was 2 a.m. I was like totally shocked. You know, I was like, I felt like they were profiling me. And so I was like, this ain't right. You know what I mean? And I just felt like super unlucky. I was like, I can't believe what's going on, right? And so I was bummed out about that. I continued on for a while with that. You know, I was always the guy when I had a few drinks in me, you know, I'd feel like, you know, we got those guys and we don't got those guys. I got her number and I don't got her number. You know what I mean? I was always the guy, like, be a 2-on-5 fight, and I'd always be on the 2 side. You know what I mean? Cause, and I learned later, it's not really like losing a fight, you know, if there's a lot of extra guys there, right? It's kind of brave, right? That makes sense. Some people know what I'm talking about. So anyways, you know, like I got the next DUI. The first DUI really bummed me out. I pulled over the car, and I remember by Great America, and I was crying in the car about that. I was like, I got a DUI, my life's over, this is it, I'm gonna be marked, all this stuff. When I got the next DUI a year and a half later, like, I didn't even feel it, man. I didn't even feel it. I was working on a project in British Columbia for my job up there. And we're coming back over the border. They're like, you got some DUIs? I'm like, yeah, I got some DUIs. And they put me in a hotel room with like a Mountie, and they deported me. You know what I mean? They deported me from Canada. And again, I just felt like super unlucky. I'm like, this, I can't believe this stuff is happening. Put myself through college. I did a lot of work. And, you know, I thought it's just like work hard, play hard, and that's what was up. And so I ended up coming back to Fresno. I tried really hard to get out of Fresno when I was living in the Bay Area. I felt really demoralized. I felt really hopeless when I had to come back to Fresno. For the second DUI, I got out of... I was in Milpitas in Elmwood for like 26 days for not doing my community service. And I remember being in there and thinking, you know, I'm not a criminal. And I remember writing in there, I wrote this letter, you know, that said basically, you know, I don't like wearing orange clothes. I don't like cold bologna sandwiches. I don't like watching Telemundo. I don't like sleeping in a room with 40 dudes. And I don't know whatever it is that I'm so angry about, but whatever it is, right? Like, it's not worth my freedom. And I'm gonna quit drinking when I get out of here, and I'm gonna figure this out. And like, if it's my family and I don't gotta see my family, whatever, but nothing's worth my freedom. And I got out of there and I was sober for about 2, maybe 3 weeks before somebody passed a beer at me, and I went and I was off again. And so I proceeded like that. And I had to come back to Fresno, and you know, I came back to Fresno. I got another job. I was living at my mom's trailer in Kalwa in southeast Fresno for like 9 months, and I was super bummed out about that. I thought, you know, I've put myself through school. I've gotten out of this, and here I am back in this situation again, and it was terrible. But I ended up getting another job. It took me 9 months to get another job. I got another job. I started to string it together, but I told myself, okay, I'm back in Fresno. I won't do anything else, but at least I should be able to drink. And I won't do anything else, but I should be able to drink, right? I mean, there's Bud Light commercials, Super Bowl, like every red-blooded American's drinking, so I should be able to drink. And that didn't work out so well for me. Like, I like to hang out in like divey dive bars. You know what I mean? There's a little questionnaire, and it says, do you hang out with lower companions in inferior environments? And I thought, now how do they know that? Right? I used to hang out at the bar, the other bar, and the next bar in Fresno, and Crossroads, and you know, just divey bars. I like to be in divey bars. And I went on like that for a while. And on a Monday night, I went with my friend to practice for pool league, which was on Tuesday, and he drove there, and the girl I was dating showed up there, and he left, and I had like a pitcher, I had like a 60-ounce pitcher. If I'd have known it was going to be my last drink, I certainly wouldn't have had that crappy beer. I'd had a scotch, but I did not know that, and it was not my choice. And so I had a pitcher. Some guy left some money on the table. I said, you don't leave money on a table in this bar. People are going to take your money. He's nice enough to buy me a pitcher. So, of course, I drank that. I had two. I was like, I might as well have a third. And then I had a fourth. So I had like four 60-ounce pitchers. And I felt fine. And I was looking at the girl I'm dating. And I was like, I'm straighter than she is. I'm like, I can drive us home. It was Monday night. I left down Fresno and Escalon. And I saw the lights go on again. And the lights went on. It pulled me over. And he put me in the back of the car again. And I just remember looking at myself through the grate in the cop car and saying like I'd never been to an AA meeting. I didn't know anything about recovery or anything like that, but I just remember saying to myself, like, I gotta do something different. I'm like, I'm too pretty for prison. I don't want to go to jail, and I gotta do some different stuff, right? And I figured I was going to do like a little bit of time for that. And it just so happened that like enough time had passed from my first DUI that they ended up punishing me like it was my second DUI. But anyways, it was my third. And the next day, you know, terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair, all that. I was like, here we go again. Like all this stuff. I'm living in a 700 square foot apartment. You know, it's got like drywall holes like all over the apartment. Like I'm moving pictures around to like cover up the drywall holes because I would get drunk and angry and put my hand through the drywall, and I would just like move the stuff around, and I'm just like, man. So now I'm on my bike. I get a lawyer. The lawyer says, you got to start going to AA. And I'm like, look, I'll drop and give you 50. I'll do laps. You want me to swim backwards? Whatever it is, I'll do it. So I got to make sure that I don't end up back on my mom's couch. And I've never really been like suicidal, but you know, I was like, I don't know if I could take going through this again. And when I say I don't know if I could take it, I'll say that there was probably some more options on the table than I care to recognize at the time. And so I started going to AA, and I had the little book, you know, that you had to get signed. And you know, I was really confused. These people were talking about weird stuff. I was like, I'm not as old as that guy. I'm not as young as that person. I'm smarter than that person. I'm not as dumb as that person. I found all these ways to be different than everybody. I really thought that I wasn't as bad as most people. I came in with like three DUIs. There was always like some guy with like 13 DUIs in there, and I was like, I don't even have like any. I've like got a quarter of the DUIs he's got. You know what I mean? So those were the things I would be focusing on. And fortunately for me, this guy came, and this really old guy, he looked kind of lonely. He looked like he needed somebody to talk to. And he came up to me and he said, hey, you know, you want to get together and read this book? What I realized later is really good at sniffing the desperation on people. And you know, fortunately for me, he was not judging me by what was coming out of my mouth, because he knew I wasn't capable of telling the truth. But he was judging my willingness based on my actions. And he said, hey, you want to get together and read this book? And I was like, okay, when? And he's like, how about now? And I'm like, okay. And I was riding my bike because I'd had the DUI. My license was suspended. And you know, he's like, well, I can't fit your bike in my car. He's like, you're going to have to follow me over here. And so I'm following this old guy down the street. I remember riding my bike down Sunnyside, and I'm just like thinking, this is what it's come to. You know what I mean? I'm following this like strange old dude that's like lonely. He could be a serial killer for all I know. Like, I have no idea what's going on. I have no idea when we get wherever I have no idea where we're going. I have no idea when we get there what we're going to do. And I have zero idea what any of this has to do with getting me out of the predicament that I'm in right now, which is I'm just trying to keep my job and keep myself from winding up back on my mom's couch, because I'm not really sure if I can take that. And we sat down, and he proceeded to basically read this book with me. And you know, he would turn the statements into questions, and he showed me how to read this book. And the way to read this book is pretty. It says in the preface, we hope you'll pause as you're reading this and ask yourself some questions. Has that happened to me? Have I felt like that? And do I believe this program can work for me too? And he showed me how to basically. I would read books before, like, just I'm pretty good at taking tests. You know, I would read books, get the key points, and like, okay, you know, do all right on the multiple choice, but not really have it like sink in. And he would basically take me through that, and I started to see myself in the pages of Alcoholics Anonymous, this book, as we were reading it. I started to realize, as we were like reading Bill's story, that I drank like how Bill drank. And I started to realize that it wasn't, you know, you don't have DUIs don't make you an alcoholic. Not having them don't make you an alcoholic. Having them doesn't make you an alcoholic. You know, in my experience, having several is a good indicator, but that doesn't doesn't make you alcoholic. And what I learned as a result of going through the steps with this guy was that, you know, if when you honestly want to quit, you find you cannot, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. And that was my experience, you know. Once I popped, I couldn't stop. And when I wanted to stop and stay stopped, and I had every reason to stop and stay stopped, and I had everything riding on me continuing to be stopped, and I had all these things going in my favor, I still couldn't stop and stay stopped. I would always find some insanely trivial reason to say, you know what, it's cool, I'll be cool, this time will be different. Every other time hasn't been different, but this time will be different. And so he proceeded to take me through the rest of the steps, and somewhere in there, you know, I started to relate to this section of the book. I thought I'd read this. You know, and I started to believe that because my experience was similar enough to what some of the other people were saying, I started to believe what it says here on page 25. I started to believe that there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. I started to believe that these people had a solution. When I first went there, I thought, these people ain't sober that long. They ain't stone cold sober. You know what I mean? Like, they're doing something. And then I started to believe them. You know, I thought, these people are actually sober. Some other things happened there for me. I went through the steps. Some highlights of that is I did my first four step. We did a fifth step. I went home. I was very good at cataloging, you know, everybody that I was pissed off at. I was very good at that. I catalog a lot of that stuff. It's a long list. I knew who I was pissed off at very well. I remembered even some of the dates. I knew why I was pissed off at them. I was clear on what it affected, but I was completely unclear on my part. And I went home and I reviewed the fifth step. My sponsor told me that basically the steps in the book are contractual, meaning that if I do them how I'm supposed to do them, then there are certain results that are basically promised to us. And one of the promises in the fifth step, as after I did my fifth step with him, I went home and I reviewed the fifth step promises. And there's one in there that says, you will often feel like you're walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And I'm like, I'm not walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And I went back to Jack and I'm like, Jack, I'm not walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And I distinctly remember him not blinking. I distinctly remember him like not thinking about an answer. I distinctly remember that I felt like he spoke really fast, but he's like, well, I guess we missed something. We better go back. And I'm like, go back to where? And he's like, well, go back to one. He's like, I don't know what we missed. And we went right back. I had about 9 months sobriety and we went right back to step one and started over. And for me, that was a grow or go moment. I was either going to basically say to heck with that and go and do my own thing again, which I pretty much knew where that led, or I was going to continue on in that process and grow. And I was desperate enough and I was crazy enough and I had just enough been restored, just enough to sanity enough to know that, left to my own devices on a long enough timeline, I was going to drink again. Like that thing that she read at the beginning where it talks about, you know, go over and try some controlled drinking. You know, he would tell me, like, go see if you can drink a beer for like one day for 30 days in a row. And I'd be like, well, I can't do that. I'm like, can I not drink and then drink 30 at the end? You know what I mean? Because I can do that. I can go for a month and then I think I can do that, but I can't drink just one a day. And I was clear on that. And so I went back to step one, and this time I focused a little bit harder. I tried to get a little bit more open-minded about the God thing. I would often pray stuff like the set-aside prayer. God, while I was doing the step, God, please help me to set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. Please allow me to see the truth about my need to come to believe in a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And praying that prayer got me a little bit more open-minded. And my higher power helped me to get a little bit more open-minded that maybe I didn't have all the answers. Because I always, you know, there's a line in the 12 and 12 says, you know, we like to be called precocious. We like to be like we were intelligent beyond our years. And I always thought I was smarter than other people. And I started going to this young people's thing. And I was 31 when I came in. I started going to this young people's thing. And there was some, I thought they were girls. They were really young. And I thought these girls, I'm like, those girls, I'm like, I know more than them. And then there was a situation that occurred. And these women, like, responded to this situation in a way that clearly demonstrated that they were much more mature than I was. And I was like, I was aware that they had got that maturity as a result of being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized that maybe for the first time in my life, I'm not ahead of the curve. Maybe I'm behind the curve. And maybe I need to, like, get my act together and, like, put everything I have into this. And honestly, I didn't believe this stuff was going to work. I didn't believe it was going to work for a good solid year and a half. I started to really believe it was taking it about 2 years. My grandfather died of cirrhosis of the liver at 44. There's a lot of terrible things that went on. I'm not going to rehash them, but I didn't experience them. I just would be told them by other members of my family. And, you know, I thought that I was headed there. I started to realize that I was on the same path that he was on. And I thought, if I'm going to be on that same path and I'm going to end up at the same place and I'm dying on a bar stool someday because I'm drinking a fifth of vodka every day, even though my grandkids are born and I'm getting ready to die and I'm still drinking a fifth of vodka, I was like, I want to know that I at least left everything on the field with this AA thing. I want to know that at least I tried this thing, because there's a whole bunch of stuff in my life that I half-assed and barely tried and ducked out of, and I'm not really sure if it would have worked if I'd have really put my back into it. And I thought, if I'm going to die from this, I at least want to know that I gave this like the full shot. And I started, you know, I basically went about it that way. And I got involved in this young people's thing. And like I said, I thought I was smarter than them. I thought, you know, I was always different. I was too old for the young people and too young for the old people and too old for the young people and too young for the old people. You know what I'm saying? So, but I was always different, right? And I just felt different than people. And so I went in there and I started to realize, like, maybe I'm not different, right? Maybe I'm just not as special as I think that I am, you know? And my sponsor started like saying really weird stuff to me. He's like, have you ever considered that, like, maybe you're not like the, I'm a programmer. I work on computers, right? He's like, maybe you're not like the smartest programmer ever. Maybe you're just like an okay programmer. He's like, what would that mean to you? How would that affect you? You know? And that stuff started to hit me like really weird. And I started to think, you know, maybe I'm not a beautiful and unique snowflake, right? And I started to not feel different than everybody else. And I went to this young people's thing, I was so scared that like my life was gonna be over, right? I was like, if I get sober, man, I was like, I don't know what I'm gonna do for the next like 60 years. Like, what am I gonna do, right? And you know, I remember reading this other thing that I wanted to share with you guys, you know, and it says, we have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life, it says, which I believe means there's a choice. Okay. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Right? So I basically like this idea that we weren't a glum lot, right? And I started participating in this young people's deal, and I felt weird. I felt like a 12-year-old at a junior high dance, right? And I was like, I mean, I can't dance sober. I can't do these things. It feels weird. And then, like, they were going on this camping trip one time up by the American River that this East Bay Young People's Group held. And I went up there. I was like, I've never been camping sober. Every time I went camping, I was blitzed, right? Like, we were out there. There was no police, whatever. I'd be blitzed. And we went on this camping trip, and I started to realize, like, there's like 300 people there, and they're all young, and they're all having a good time, and they're all sober. And I started to realize, like, Like, this is what it looks like. Like, this is doable. It's not like, my life isn't over. I just have to find these other activities and basically participate in these other things. And so I started doing that, and I got really involved in that young people's group. I took some positions in there. Like I said, I'm a programmer, and I didn't really feel like I was a people person, because after 10 years of drinking, I'd been isolating and isolating and isolating. And they gave me this position, which caused me to like talk to other people. I was like co-inreach, and I would go to these meetings in like various places around Fresno County and try and encourage people who are young to come to the young people's meeting there in Fresno. And, you know, I gradually started to talk to people, and I started to open up, and I got another position, and then I got another position. And we were bidding for this conference, and we got really involved in bidding for that conference. And then, and actually my friend Sandra here was treasurer at the first ACCUPAW that I went to down in San Diego in 2010. And, you know, we went down there, and I had been to a conference there for church, like earlier in my life, and we went down there, and there was like, there's probably like 2,500 people there, and there are 2,500 young people sober at the Town and Country in San Diego, all in a meeting, all having a great time. And I mean, it just blew my hair back, man. I mean, it got me so fired up, and I was like, this is fun. This is like, my life is not over. I can have a good time, and all these people are doing it, and I'm not like the only person in my county that's young trying to get sober, and there's people that are younger than me, and who are getting and staying sober. And so I just got totally dialed into that. And you know, then somewhere around there, I started sponsoring guys when I had about a year and a half sobriety. And I remember reading the 9-step promises with my sponsor the first time. One of the promises in there says, "Self-seeking will slip away." And I distinctly told Jack, I was like, "Jack, I'm not interested in self-seeking slipping away. I'm like, I didn't come here to change like my problems for someone else's problems. I got my own problems." And he's like, "All right, well," he's like, "just keep doing this." And he told me, you know, that if I was an alcoholic, like he was an alcoholic, that, you know, I'd have to take people through this process like I was being taken through the process. And he explained to me that him taking me through the process was an integral part of his sobriety. And it oftentimes kept him sober when nothing else had kept him sober. And I didn't really believe that. For a while, you know, he would say stuff like, you know, "This is probably helping me more than it's helping you." And, you know, I didn't really believe that. I thought, that's a very interesting brainwashing technique you're using right there. But later on, I've worked with some guys, and I'm pretty sure it was helping me more than it was helping them, and I know what he's talking about. So I started working with guys, and you know, it talks about in the book, it says, you know, one of our guys worked with a half dozen prospects, and none of them stayed sober. And I was getting bummed out. I was working with these guys, and I was spending like all my valuable time with these dudes, right? And they were not getting sober. You know what I mean? My valuable time, my precious time, you know what I mean, is so valuable that I was just wasting it on these guys that weren't getting sober, you know? And I've been with like 6 or 7 people. I've been working with like 6 or 7 guys. And I went to this one meeting, and there was a speaker there, and the speaker said, like, every time I work with a guy, he's like, it works 100% of the time. It's 100% effective. Like, it always works. And I'm like, "You're crazy." I'm like, "Whatever." I'm like, "How do you mean? What?" And then they're like, "Because basically when I leave there, like, I'm still sober. Like, whatever happens with them, like, I'm still sober." And it hit me. I'm like, "That's true. I'm working with these guys, and I'm all focused on the results and the outcome. And the truth is that I'm staying sober as a result of being involved in that process." And somewhere in there, I started, you know, to kind of step off back of the results business, and I just kind of got a little bit more involved in like the footwork business. And then weird things started happening. Like some guys would like stay sober for a while, and then they would go back out, and then some guys would stay sober for like a little bit longer, you know. And you know, now I'm working with guys that, you know, most of them have multi-year sobriety, you know what I mean? And, like, that's different. That was different than it was when I first started. But if I hadn't started with all those people, all those guys I worked with, all those guys, I started the steps with about 25 guys. I'm 9 years sober, and I've started step one with about 25 guys. Of all those guys helped keep me sober. I'm not sure which one of those dudes, if I hadn't worked with them, that I would be sober now. I'm not sure which one of those guys I could have said, nah, I don't need to work with that guy. I'll be cool. And, you know, that's the formula, that's part of the formula for staying sober around here, is you got to trust God, clean house, and help others. And helping others has really helped to keep me sober. There's some other things that have gone on. The main thing I would say the Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is that it's basically helped me to understand that I'm not a victim. You know, when I was drinking, I felt like a guy that was just walking around getting hit by random lightning bolts. You know what I mean? I'll be like, everything would be going cool, and then all of a sudden, broken nose. You know, everything's going cool, all of a sudden, another DUI. You know, everything's going cool, and I wake up in some house with some people that I don't know, and I don't know how I got there. You know what I mean? And what the steps taught me was basically that I'm not a victim. And I learned that I'm not like a guy walking around getting hit by lightning bolts, but I'm like a little kid with a fork in my hand running around sticking the fork into light sockets. And as a result of doing the steps, it's helped me to basically not stick the fork into the light sockets like so many times. And as a result of doing that, right, my life has gotten a lot different and it's gotten a lot better. A lot of things happened in sobriety that I didn't think were going to happen. I got the opportunity to pay back my creditors. I got out of my student loan debt. I never thought that was going to happen. Those people were never going to see that money. They were never going to see that money. And I got out of that. That job that I was totally afraid that I was not going to be able to keep, I ended up keeping that job. I now work from home. It's a pretty good deal. It allows me a lot of freedom to work with some of the guys that I work with. Also, I'm in that home, right? I wouldn't be in that home if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous. It allowed me to basically get involved in a relationship, you know, and that relationship, you know, I remember I was going out with her, and her dad came to me and was like, you know, hey, you know, like, what's your intentions with my daughter type thing? And I was like, we had been dating about a year and a half, and I was like, I tried to be as honest as I could with him, and I just told him, I said, you know, I'm trying to, this is the first unselfish relationship in my life. I'm involved in, this is the first time I've tried to have an unselfish relationship in my life. And, you know, for whatever reason, that like seemed to make sense to him, right? And he kind of laid off. And we continue to be in that relationship. We've been together 7 years. I proposed to her. We're getting married in a couple of months, a little bit less than like 45 days. And, you know, there's been some deaths in our family the last year since I proposed. And that's been difficult, you know what I mean? And I've learned that, like, there are things that I, like, can't control. And I've also learned, you know, the truth of this thing I'll read again here, which I believe is kind of sums up what's going on. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. What I learned is that we're all going to have certain trials and low spots in our life. There's a lot of pain that happens in people's lives. Some of that pain, you know, pain in my life has fallen into three categories. It's mostly fallen into the large category of self-inflicted pain, like that kid that's going around sticking the fork in light sockets. There's another category of pain that's basically pain that's kind of inflicted by other people that I'm in relationship with. As a result of caring about these people, I experience pain. And that's part of life, and I don't get a pass on that. And then there's another kind of pain that's just like seems to be like beyond my control. I don't know where it comes from. I realized that we're all going to have that. And like the problem that I had fallen into when I was going to church when I was younger was I had fallen into like a transactional relationship with God. I'd say, God, I'll do this for you. I'll go to Bible study. I'll do this, whatever, whatever. But I better get mine on the back end. And I learned that you can't really bargain with God. That's not how it works. And since I came to AA, I've been able to pretty much steer clear of that. And I find people in AA making that same mistake. You know, they say, well, God, I'll do this and this and this for my sobriety as long as I get this, this, and this. And then when that doesn't happen, then they go their own way. And so I've tried to realize that there are certain pain that I can't get away from. And I wouldn't want to get away from, because it's not really a have to go through that pain. It's a get to go through that pain. I get to be there for my family. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to suit up and show up, whether I felt like it or didn't feel like it. Sometimes when it was my off day, sometimes when it was my on day, it's taught me to basically suit up and show up and try to be there for the people that I care about. And if I didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous, I know for a fact that wouldn't happen, because it wasn't happening in my life when I was younger. It was all about me. And as a result of it being all about me, I was never satisfied. The things that I guess that I will kind of finish up with here is, I will say, if you're new or relatively new and you forget everything else that I said, I highly encourage you to get a sponsor and to do the steps with them. In my experience, the steps are an incremental process which is designed to transmit a spiritual experience sufficient enough for you to recover from alcoholism, to recover from the need to basically keep drinking even when you don't want to drink. And if you can do that, then you don't have to experience the allergy. All of that's predicated on me basically getting together, one alcoholic talking to another one-on-one, and basically getting involved in this process called the steps. So if you're new or relatively new, I highly encourage you to do that. If you've been around here for a while, and you're like, yeah, I know that, and you're not working with some people, and it's not like inconvenient for you, and you know, like things are just kind of coasting, and you're feeling like stuff is missing out, my suggestion is to put your hand out and do what my sponsor did for me, and judge these newcomers basically by the willingness that they have to act, not on what they say. He didn't come up and say, hey Rob, are you willing to go to any lengths? Because at that time I was not willing to go to any lengths. But he asked me, you want to get together? You want to work these steps? And I was like, okay. And he caught me in what the book calls a lucid interval, which I believe is a window of willingness. And you catch these people in a window of willingness, and they'll be willing to do something. And we got to meet them where they're at. And if you do that, my life has not been boring since I've been doing that. I'd like to thank Bill for asking me to come and speak. I'd like to thank all of you for your time. And I'd like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous and my higher power for my life and another day of sobriety. Thank you.